The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of both the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, please visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. First, I'd like to thank the mountain who is giving us her lap to sit in this morning, and this boundless sky for gazing at us, and to the First Nations people who took care of this land for so many thousands of years before our European ancestors ran them off. We're indebted. And to you, who I don't quite recognize without a square around your head, but I'll get used to it. So nice to have you here. And you. So this is from Dogme Zanpo's 37 verses on the practice of a bodhisattva, to let go of this life. Verse number 4. Married friends and relatives will separate. Possessions gained with effort will be left behind. Consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of the body. To let go of this life is the practice of a bodhisattva. The Buddha said again and again that whatever is born will die, whatever is high will fall, whatever accumulates will exhaust itself, and whatever gathers in will disperse. Impermanence is the nature of everything. Even mountains eventually become level with the plain. Even stars eventually burn out. Everything is ceaselessly changing, but how is it changing? What does change mean? This is such an important part of the Dharma practice and our reflection, is to understand, particularly in our own language, in our English language, what do these words mean? What do they mean in Buddhism? How are they pointing to ourselves? We can think of something as being self-existing on its own, and just changing into another self-existing autonomous being, like a caterpillar becomes a butterfly. We can think of the things that the characteristics change about someone, like a person from infancy to childhood to adulthood to old age. But within all those changing characteristics, something doesn't change, something eternal, something essential. We call it the self. And what the Buddha is saying is that within birth and death, gathering and dispersing, ascending and falling, that's happening all the time. It's happening every moment. If we could actually see it happening in every moment, we would explode, probably, because it happens so quickly that we wouldn't be able to create a coherent sense of the things around us and inside of us. And so in a sense, it's good that we can't actually see that change happening in the moment when it's happening at its ultimate level. But that also then becomes this seat of our delusion, because we take that continuity for something permanent. And so at the ultimate, there is nothing that changes, not in this way. And yet, within our everyday experience, we recognize a birth, a gathering, accumulating, reaching a summit, and how each of those things end. We celebrate, we mourn. And so those early verses in this text are really pointing to all of the places of our greatest attachment, which in another way of thinking is just where we are most vulnerable to attachment, where we are most asleep, we might say, to that change, to the appearing and disappearing. And so these verses have looked at our the relationships we have that are loving, the relationships we have that are not. They're aversive. They pointed to the seeds of our delusion, to places, physical places, both in the mind and body and also in the world around us, and how our mind uses those various things to distract ourselves, to become confused, to feel threatened, to be seduced. The new master Vitaka said that one who renounces the world or is free of all attachments has no personal self, no personal possessions, is mentally neither aroused nor oblivious. This is the essential way. This is the eternal way. The mind has no shape or form in its essence. The essence of mind is the same. And so Zenpo says, old friends and relatives will separate. We're social beings. We're relational beings. Every sensation we have, everything we know, which is based on a sensation through our senses, is our mind coming into contact and in that moment creating a relationship with something. Sometimes it's a contact that has happened again and again and again, and so it's a new relationship in essence, but in our karmic mind we see it as a continuity, a continuum. Sometimes it's something that we may experience has never happened before. And most of it are things that just pass by. Sometimes they get our attention. Someone cuts you off in traffic. Someone smiles at you unexpectedly at the store. You watch the news and hear people of great power talking about things. And in those moments of contact, there's a relation between ourselves and that thing. And so we have relationships with our mother and father, even if we never met them. That's the basis of our relationship with grandparents, family members, siblings, friends, relationship with animals, relationship with teachers, mentors, Dharma friends, workers. We also have relationships with inanimate things, the place of our birth, trees, cars, pens, cities, landscapes, rivers. And those relationships are really the basis. They're like the everyday treasures of our life. They can give so much meaning and enjoyment and pleasure in our life. And they're also the source of our disappointment, our dissatisfaction, our pain. Some of those relationships last briefly in our consciousness. Some last a lifetime in our consciousness. But all of them end. That's what Zenpo is saying. All of them end. A relationship ends, a friend moves away and falls out of contact. A Dharma friend stops practicing or practices elsewhere. A co-worker leaves for another job. A pet dies. And everyone here in 80 years, say, 90 years, will no longer be here. All of the thoughts, the emotions, all of our concerns will be gone. All of the things that we put all of our energy into, creating, building, will one day disappear. And this is a basic truth. When the Buddha taught this, he wasn't creating a value judgment. We already do that. He was basically saying, this is just the way the universe works. But because of this, relationships can cause so much pain, so much sorrow, be such a source of so much mental obsession, agonizing, at the same time that they can give such profound enjoyment and meaning, our companionships, our purpose, legacies. And we can think of all of those things that we derive from our relationships as possessions, something that we have, memories, everyday experiences, the status that we might feel from certain relationships, the identities that we create or that are strengthened. All attachments are like possessions, something that we have. And that possession can be something we're invested in having and possessing, keeping close to us, or the possession can be something that we want to keep far away from us. not have be an active part of our lives. And so Zanpo says, possessions gained with effort will also be left behind. These two will disperse, exhaust themselves. They have a life span, just like a thought, just like an emotion, just like a situation, just like a government, like a country, like an ideology. They all have a lifespan. And so in addition to people that we're related to, or creatures, animal creatures, we're also related, we're in relationship to things, our possessions, things that are we possess in our lives, objects, the things of human life, our homes, furniture, paintings, books, pots and pans, bikes, cars, photographs, gadgets. Material, all the material things that are what we do and how we do it. We might make some of them. We buy some of them. Some of them we receive as gifts. Some of them we inherit. Some of them we might steal. Some come to us easily and are might be of lesser importance. Some come with great effort, tremendous effort, sometimes years of effort, and sacrifice. It may be of great importance. And all of this, all of the meaning, in a sense, the relationship, not just with the thing, but all of the things of that thing, what it means to us, how it came to us, becomes the basis of our attachments. Or not. You know, attachments aren't just reserved for certain categories of things. We apply them liberally. Right? We apply them to everything and anything. The things that are at the top of our list, the things that are at the bottom of our list, things we love, things we hate, things we think are important, things we don't, things we see, things we don't see. Things that are alive and in front of us, things that are long gone. Things that exist, things that have never existed except in our mind. Shanti Davis said, my enemies at length will cease to be, my friends and family, and I myself will cease to be. Everything is likewise destined to pass away for destruction. Everything I use and possess is like a fleeting vision of a dream. When you're dreaming, it's vivid, it's awake, you're in contact, you wake up, and it, in a matter of instants, is gone. It fades into the realm of memory, and fading, it's gone forever. The thought never came to my mind that I, too, am a brief and passing thing. I haven't really thought about that much. I haven't reflected on that. I've tried to keep that at bay. When those messengers, as the Buddha called them, came to me, I disregarded them. They were here for somebody else, not me. I haven't considered that I too am a brief and passing thing, that everything around me, everyone around me is a brief and passing thing. And now reflecting on that, many of the things that I have done out of greed, anger, delusion, pride, and jealousy have caused so much trouble. But all the while, never halting, Shanti Deva says, night or day, my life is slipping, slipping by. This glorious day will never happen again, ever. This gathering will never happen again, ever, in the history of the world. Think of that. And in that way, it is utterly unique. It is profound. It is the only thing. And at the same time, because we have many such days, not this day, but such days, that it can slip into being unnoticed. My life is slipping, slipping by, and nothing that I gain can be regained. And what but death could be my destiny. I know this. Why are teachers always pointing to impermanence? You know, whenever we see a teaching again and again and again coming up within, from this teacher, through the course of their life of teachings, through various teachers, through different schools of teaching, through different traditions of Buddhism, when we see the same teachings come up, there's a reason why, right? They point to what we may have already seen, but we want to avoid. They point to what we haven't seen and don't want to see. Or they might point to things that we haven't seen but want to, deeply. There is no dukkha, there is no pain and suffering without attachment. There is no attachment without desire, and there is no desire without a sense of self. It's that simple and it's that profound. And so Zanpo says, consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of your body to get level of this life is the practice of a bodhisattva. And of course, that doesn't mean to disregard our life, to think that it doesn't matter, has no value. I mean, just look at the history of Buddhism. If that were true, the Buddha wouldn't have taught. He wouldn't have devoted the whole of his life to the Sangha. It means when we're alive, be alive. It means you don't have to be held back in life. It means make a commitment to not holding others back in life. It means step forward from Buddha nature into your awakened state and help others to do that in whatever small or large ways you can. And we can't do those things if we're devoted to clinging. It's just not going to happen, right? Or the degree to which it happens will be the degree to which our clinging is unstable, which in a sense is what we're trying to do, is destabilize what has been stable, destabilize our attachment, our clinging, our fear, our reactivity, our mental proliferation. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha said to Subhuti, all bodhisattvas who set out on the bodhisattva path should reflect deeply on this. However many beings there are, however they come into this world, born from eggs, from wombs, those who are born with form or without form, in the realm of complete nirvana, I, you, the bodhisattva, will liberate them all. And though you thus liberate countless beings, know that not a single being is liberated. Why? The Buddha says, if a bodhisattva has the perception of a self, of a person, of another being or thing, or of a life, they are not yet fully awakened as a bodhisattva. Awakened to a self is that sense of self. Awakened to the person is our personhood, our sense of who we are, our body, our mind, all that we do, all that we have. Another being is other people's selves and bodies and minds, and the bodies and minds of things, and of a life, this thing that we have. Right? We are alive, meaning we have life, and one day it's as though it will be taken away from us. But a bodhisattva does not live within the perception of those things, not as having an existence, but having inherent existence. That they see them as existing like clouds passing, like the morning dew on the grass. Something that appears, but only for a moment, and has no ultimate lasting nature. And so these teachings that we're studying, this Anga and the whole of Ango, is dedicated to freeing us from these attachments. Not just so our lives become more alive, but because we can also then, as we're learning how to free ourselves, we're simultaneously learning how to help others, how to truly be skillful. You know, students ask questions about this all the time. There's a certain situation, there's a certain person, there's a circumstance at work, there's something going on within my family. Something just happened here within the resident Sangha. Something happened in the dialogue with a teacher. Something happens every time I look at this person on the news speaking. Relationships. Bound. Troubled. Agitated. Confused. How to respond? The question is so often, how do I respond? What can I do with this person in this situation? And perfectly valid questions. But the first question that we should ask is, where is your mind? Because the relationship fundamentally is there. When we're not seeing things clearly, the moment of contact with the person or the thing or the situation is like it's like in a piece of classical music, the first measures of the piece that you usually hear are the theme, right? The melody, the thing that you can hum along with. All the rest is the story about that theme. And so we see something, we experience something, we hear somebody's voice, we see a certain situation, and we don't see it for the first time, even though it's happening for the first time. We see it with all of our accumulated experiences and attachments. And our mind begins to instantly graft onto that being, that thing, that situation. All of that sense of self, of person, of being, of life. And that's why one of the reasons it's so important to do Zazen is because we simplify the field as much as we can so that we can get to the root, return to the source, get there to see the mind before the first thought arises. And then seeing the first thought arise, see that thought arise. See it clearly. See it as it is. A monk was asked, Master Daswe, when the fire at the end of the eon rages through the whole universe and everything is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? This essential nature, my basic nature, who I am? Daswe said, destroyed. The student says, then it all goes along in the fire? And Daswe said, all goes along. Nothing remains. And there are moments in our life like that, where everything seems to collapse. The ground seems to fall away. Everything we thought was, we thought we were, suddenly, we're not so sure. And so Zanpo says, consciousness, the guest, will leave the guest house of the body. He's speaking about death, but it's really also happening in every moment. That is the nature of consciousness itself. While it continues, it brings forth in each moment an experience, contact, a relationship. The body and mind at birth join together. We call this birth. At death, the body disperses into the four elements. We call that death. You know, that's one reason I think it's so important to sit here. This is our oldest memory. This is our oldest experience, going back to our original ancestors. And for millennia, this was what there was. And it's in us. And I think when we sit in the midst of let's call them the natural elements, I think there's a mingling, a subtle mingling, a kind of recognition that we're experiencing, not so much through our thoughts, not through poetic verse and, you know, waxing on, but at a very deep level that we may or may not even be aware of. So when those four elements dissolve, consciousness, which is neither alive nor dead, not born nor dies, leaves the guest house, leaves the body, driven by, from a Buddhist understanding, driven by desire. It's still hungry. It wants more. And so it seeks a new guest house so it can continue. And so in the teachings of rebirth, that grasping, that clinging to life, that seeking more is not yet finished, not yet exhausted. It's said that at the Buddha's enlightenment, he said, at this moment, I and all creatures everywhere attain the way, realize liberation. So every time anyone experiences directly the nature of being, the nature of the self, what is realized in that moment is that everyone is liberated. And though it may not yet be clear, if they continue training, they will see more and more clearly that in fact, no one has actually been liberated. That the suffering that we are bound in is not the suffering that we imagine it to be. And there is suffering. Another student asked Master Daswe, the same master, when the fire at the end of the eon rages and everything is destroyed, will this be destroyed or not? And Daswe said, not destroyed. The student says, why is it not destroyed? And Daswe said, because it's the same as the universe. Because it's the same as the universe. The fire burning and all that it burns have one nature. And though many beings are freed from suffering, the Bodhisattva realizes they have not liberated a single one and have devoted all of their life to doing whatever they can to diminish or release that suffering. And so walking the Bodhisattva path, how do we practice this today? Be in relationship with your keen awareness, your clear-seeing mind. Strive to see ever more clearly what we call the subject and the object. The one, the place from which you look out, and that which you look upon. And see that with a keen awareness and acceptance that it will end. That moment, that relationship, that object, that person. And knowing that now ever more deeply, not as some distant thing, but as a now thing. Cherish it. Savor it. Do that thing that you should do. Say that thing you should say. When we really understand this, then we deeply yearn, want that our presence in each other's life be as good as it can possibly be. The Bodhisattva vow becomes more and more your deepest desire. See that person, that place, that thing for what it is rather than what we want it to be, rather than what we think it should be. And receive its offering. You know, whatever it's offering, how it enriches your life, how it gives you something, without imposing unrealistic, self-centered ideas and desires upon it. And as practitioners, recognize when we're attached. Right? Attachment always leaves signs. It always leaves a trail. Sometimes it's breadcrumbs. Sometimes it's a river of blood. It always leaves a trail. And so that's our work, right, is to recognize, because attachment's just a word. Recognize that clinging, and recognize that the clinging is not anywhere outside of ourselves. It's not in the person, in the thing, and that's not even what we're clinging to. Again, the person just, or the thing just becomes sort of a springboard, a catalyst. What we're clinging to is what we feel, what that relationship makes us feel, or what we want it to make us feel. That's what we cling to. And then we go about doing whatever we can to preserve that state, that emotional state, that interior state. Just think about it. You're sitting, and suddenly your body relaxes and becomes very spacious and open. Your mind becomes very tranquil and calm. And you notice that. And you don't want to move one inch, right? Don't let a hair move, right? Lest you might lose that state. And then as we begin to see it depart, we try and, what was I doing? I think I straightened my back right before I do it. Let me try that. To see how our identity gets all tangled up within everything that I'm calling a relationship. Right? And relationship, again, just means contact between this body and mind are your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your skin, your mind, and something. And watch them change. Sometimes it grows stronger. Sometimes it begins to wane and dissolve. And recognize that as impermanent. That's the teaching. That's the natural truth of things. It's happening. It's not a mistake. And know that the more important something is to us, the more we're going to be challenged. Right? The more likely we will be to grasp. The harder, the more difficult it might be to let go, the more difficult it might be even to recognize the attachment. And to enjoy your possessions, right? The things that you have, the things in your life, and recognize them for what they are. They have come together, they're in your hands right now, but they'll leave. Everything arises mutually. Everything is complete unto itself. It's at peace with itself. Everything, every object is at peace within itself. That's why all things arise from emptiness as compassion. All things. Think about that. That everything in the world, whether it's so-called, man-made or human-made or is natural, it's all a form of compassion, because it in and of itself is not harming. And so whether it's a book or a car or a home or a mountain, to see them is just a book. And now let it be all that a book can be, a car. Let that car be all that the car can be, which means recognizing and taking responsibility for where it came from and where it will go. And that all of these things that are in our lives are not you, they're not me. They don't stand for you or against you. They're not there to threaten us or to affirm us. They don't love us and they don't hate us. And so when possessiveness arises, any of those things, that's our clinging. That's what the Buddha said is the idea, this is mine. I was thinking about the monastic life, where not only is the body a guest house, but robes, books, sacred objects, rakshus, all of it, right, are just, I'm borrowing them. The chromo, the robe that I was ordained in, was borrowed itself. Those days, it was hard to put two nickels together to buy a And so all that I have, I dearly hope, will be used when I'm one, just as I am using and some of you are using. Some of the things of Dada Roshis, of even of my Zenmin Roshis, the things that I don't even know where they came from, who they belong to. That in a sense, they're all possessiveness. They're just here to be used, to be useful. And our job is to let them fulfill their purpose, let them be useful. The Buddha said in the Eight Awarenesses, says, a way to work with this and help ourselves is first have few desires. He said, don't seek too much from the objects of your senses. It isn't don't have any. Have a few. Which, of course, immediately means you're going to have to make some choices, right? Because if he said, have every desire you can, that you don't have to make any choices, just grab every one. But he said, well, have a few, choose carefully. And then having chosen, know how to be satisfied with what you have. He said, know how much to take of those things you do have. So again, think of a desire as the beginning, the seed of a relationship. It's already a relationship because we're in desire with something in our mind. It's a state within us that is already we're in relationship with. But the desire is usually directed towards something, and so it's trying to initiate a relationship. And know that with every desire, it's like giving birth to something. right? And so that desire, right, some just are fleeting, but then they return, and they return, and they return. Some are intended to be sustained. But either way, they take a lot of energy, right? We have to devote time and energy to them. Energy, time, attention. And so that's the faultfulness. Is this what I want to be putting the energy of this precious human life, having attained this, which is so difficult to obtain, is this what I want to actually be devoting my energy to? And the greater the desire, the more thoughtful we should be. That's why the bodhicitta, in Shanti Deva's teaching on the Bodhisattva way of life, he says, having come this far, pause and wonder, have I been too hasty? Have I really thought this through? Do I really understand what I'm getting myself into? And then having desires, know how to be satisfied from them, which means don't expect from them what they can't give. You know, so it's like at the end of session when you start fantasizing about going out for dinner on Sunday or something you're going to make or a movie you're going to watch, and in your mind it's just like, it's ecstasy, right? It's so, going to be so, and then when you're there, it's not that. And so it's like a double loss. It's not bad, and it's not even what it could be. Because we are so pumped up for something else. And so to not project qualities into them they don't possess. When they come, greet them. Greet them within impermanence, within emptiness, within non-attachment, and enjoy them. And when they go, bow to them. Bid them well. They are not you. Remember, they don't belong. This does not belong to you. And while they're in your possession, care for them. You know, think about how in training, just think about the care that is evident in making this today possible for all of us. All of these objects that are in our possession to use, to serve us. And that if we don't take care of them, they can't do that. They want to do that. That's their completeness in this life, in this form, is to serve. If we don't allow them to do that, then in a sense everybody loses. And so we take care of them. Tools, cars, appliances, zendo, equipment, personal belongings, toothbrushes, buildings. Don't seek too much. Just have just the right amount. But the right amount for what? To let go of this life, Zangpo says. Just the right amount so we can let go of this life. So we want to have within our lives enough life in the form of relationships, in the form of people, situations, meaningful work, important things to be devoting our attention to. Because all of those things for a bodhisattva are what constitutes the path. And the purpose of the path is to let go of this life. And so to use our world of people and places and things to be more and more free of self-clinging, right? And there's no other kind of clinging other than self-clinging. Just like there's no other kind of attachment other than an anxious attachment. They're always anxious, fear-based. So never halting night or day, my life is slipping, slipping by. And nothing that has passed can be regained. And I know that death is in front of me. But then Shantideva goes on, and so, from this day forth, I go for refuge to the Buddhas, those guardians of wandering beings, who work for the good of all and everything that lives, those great beings who scatter every fear. And I take refuge in the Dharma that resides within the hearts of the bodhisattvas, which means your heart. and that scatters all the terrors of samsara, that grounds us, that aligns us, that clears our mind, that frees the dust from our eyes. When we become fearful, when we forget, and in the multitude of bodhisattvas I take refuge, all of those that with whom we walk together, which is why it's important to name and bring into our, invoke our ancestors, all of them. You know, as we are studying this throughout the Ango, and as we move further into the fall, and I think I said this at the beginning of the Ango, I think of Dada Roshi's encouragement, usually when we were going out on a trip up to the Adirondacks, but it was really good advice for all times. He would always say, prepare for the worst, hope for the best. Prepare for the worst means that which we would prefer not to happen, that which we're afraid of. And hope here doesn't mean sit and wait, but to be able to meet and enjoy what arises and make that the best. And so in that way, as we move into the fall and all that we might expect to happen and all that might unexpectedly happen into and through and on the other side of the election and as the pandemic continues to live its life in intimate relationship with human beings, and we relate to it in all manner of ways, confused and intelligent, to really keep this basic practice principle close to heart. When we see the world as something that is happening to us, we're already standing on one foot. We're already down on our knees. We're already falling. But when we understand that all things arise out of relationship, causes, it's another way of talking about karma, and that is the result of an infinite number of actions, and that we're in the midst of it, and we have a responsibility, an obligation as people, as human beings, to respond as a bodhisattva. So seeing chaos, we try to calm the chaos. Seeing anger, we try to calm the anger. Seeing greed, we try to calm the greed. Which means when and they will arise, those energies, first to see, remind and to see, is this useful? Could this be useful in this moment, provisionally? Could it be expedient? Because if it is, if it could be, then maybe it is useful. But already it's different because you're asking that question. Already it's coming from within mindfulness because you are able to ask that question. And asking that question immediately brings us into relationship with our aspiration, with people, with situations. What would be helpful? And if it's not, to attend to it, to be attentive, to see it as an object that has come into existence, and to treat it as it deserves, with respect, maybe as you quickly usher it into passing. Sometimes when things continue to arise again and again and again, they're not finished. There's something about that that's not completed. It's a way of thinking about the election. If it doesn't go the way you would like it to go, whatever way that is, and you imagine the future as whatever the future may be, maybe that's happening because something still is needing to be worked out. which means something is happening, something is moving, and it needs to continue to move. And it's not that there's a cosmic plan. It's not that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are gods and are planning our next move for our benefit. It's a way of seeing the world, which is really every moment that we are using our mind is nothing other than a way of seeing the world. Is that way useful or is it not? Is it helping us or is it binding us? And so recognizing all of these essential truths, Shantideva says, now go forth in refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take that as an affirmation.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.